From a secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler.
Journalist and essayist David Giffels has written for the New York Times Magazine, the Wall Street Journal, Grantland, and Redbook, among others. His most recent book is The Hard Way on Purpose, a collection of essays about growing up in the Akron, Cleveland area. He'll be in town with Thurber House on June 25th. For tickets, visit thurberhouse.org. Welcome, David Giffels.
Thanks for having me.
One of my previous shows, Writers Talk, did an interview with you in the 2012 Ohio Anna, when I believe you received an award from them at the book fair.
Yes, I remember it.
You described what I'm assuming was your then-emergent book, The Hard Way on Purpose, as embodying a sense of place, but a weird, surreal place, the Rust Belt.
Yes.
So tell me about that book. How did it develop for you since that time?
I've been working on this book for 5 years. You know, like any project, it evolves. So certainly at that point, I was kind of thinking about the bigger themes by that point of what this book would be. Because this book is a collection of essays that are personal, experiences of a particular place, and also kind of larger cultural explorations of what this part of the country means and is. And so I think that part of it as being kind of weird and surreal is really interesting to me, because so much of the industrial Midwest is based on science and, you know, innovations in manufacturing and all this stuff that seems, you know, slightly futuristic but also now slightly retro. And so, you know, I kind of like that aesthetic that, you know, I think Akron and places like Akron seem to embody.
What was it about the Rust Belt that was so surreal for you? Tell me a little bit about how that is surreal, because I've driven through Akron. I've actually gone to places in Akron, and I might not have used the word surreal. I might have used more words along the lines of Rust Belt, as you had described earlier. So what is there that gives that sense of the unusual or the weird for you?
Well, I think the biggest part of it for me, or the part that seems to be the most, that covers it the most broadly, is that so much of what is in cities like Akron and Detroit and Pittsburgh and Cleveland and Buffalo and so forth is this awareness of the places that used to be something else. And so, you know, I refer in the book to the Midwest as being a place where we call things by what they used to be. And so there's this kind of oddness where you know something was a factory, but now it's a restaurant, or you know it was, you know, it's like a manufacturing place that doesn't operate that way anymore. And so there's this facade, this old facade that suggests one thing, and then this interior that suggests something else, which is really interesting and exciting to me too, because so much of what I write about in the book is coming of age as a young person in a city where for a short time everything just seemed abandoned. You know, there was so much just decay and empty places that we would explore, that to see them in their emptiness and now see them, you know, in many, many cases remade into something else is, you know, that's a story, I think.
Right. You know, I grew up near Toledo, was one of the cities that I'm not sure, I don't think you mentioned, but could well have as being part of the Rust Belt and for what it used to be. And I was there recently at a mall that I spent some amount of time as an adolescent going to, and it had just been knocked down.
Good.
And so it's this, it had been apparently so badly molded that there was no way to reclaim it except by knocking it down and then using that, I don't know, returning it to farmland.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know,
yeah.
I feel a certain amount of kinship for you and for your writing about places that used to be something and are now, in this case, or in many cases when I went back, they're not much anything there in some ways anymore. And there's that sense of, I guess I was intrigued by your description of it as having a sense of place, because for me, going to these things is sort of a sense of placelessness, you know, a sense of abandonment and loss. And maybe I'm just overplaying it, but if you've driven through Toledo, you may have.
I know. You know, there's an essay in the book. My first job was as a ball boy for the Cleveland Cavaliers, and this was when they played in the old Richfield Coliseum.
Right.
And have since moved, you know, to the arena in downtown Cleveland. And so the solution to what to do with this massive arena, concrete arena, you know, in Richfield, Ohio, which is mostly kind of rural and small town, is to knock it down and give the land to the national park. So it's a very similar thing. This huge concrete edifice that so many people have memories of rock concerts and, you know, and NBA games and all this stuff is now just completely overtaken by nature, and it's beautiful, and it's been, you know, regroomed in, it's over about a decade into this. You'd never know this previous, but I still, you know, when I drive by, all my memory is like ready to see it rising up in the horizon, and it's not there, and it's a weird feeling.
Rolling Stone said of your book that it brilliantly captures how it feels to love your city fiercely, even when it's falling apart. And the thing that struck me about that particular phrase is that in a lot of ways you're talking about fiercely defending something that would in many people arise a sense of melancholy. And I'm curious about the ways that you've worked with that as you look at things like that just aren't there anymore. And that doesn't seem to be the critical take on the book that I've heard it referred to as a loving tribute to and things like that. So how did you avoid melancholy? I go back and look at the sort of shattered remains of what, you know, I remembered from growing up near Toledo and say, you know, that's sort of depressing.
Yeah. You know, for one thing, I don't think I'm overly kind to Akron. I mean, I love it as much as anybody, but, you know, there's a phrase that I use that, you know, it's like loving a three-legged dog. If you've ever had a damaged pet, you know you love that pet more because it needs you more. And so I actually hear that sense of melancholy more from people who've moved away and feel homesick. And, you know, I guess one of the fringe benefits of being an entirely parochial person who's only lived in one place my whole life is I've never felt homesick because I'm always here. So So I've seen it kind of in its evolution, including in the moment, which I guess is sort of the antidote to melancholy, because I don't long for something that used to be, but, you know, I have a pretty strong sense of the past, present, and future just by virtue of having been here the whole time.
Right. Okay. So now you're trained as a journalist.
Yes.
So do you, with the essays, it seems like you're doing journalism, but maybe of a different kind. Is this something that you're looking to go back into? And I ask that as a foreshadow of the question of, is there journalism to go back to?
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, I left journalism on purpose because it was a really difficult time. I was at the Akron Beacon Journal for 14 years, and I loved the work. The work itself is, you know, incredibly rewarding and, you know, constantly interesting and exciting. But, I mean, your question already knows the answer. The newspaper industry was in such bad straits for the past decade that, you know, I just felt like I didn't have, you know, I couldn't make the second half of my career doing that kind of work. So I don't have, I miss the work, but I don't miss the newspaper business.
Okay. Now, I've read a couple times that you were a writer for Beavis and Butthead. And
yeah.
That seems like an odd connection to have or to be put up against, you know, 14 years at the Akron Beacon Journal / writer for Beavis and Butthead. Tell me about that experience a little bit.
I would agree that it's an odd juxtaposition. That was just something that I did a little bit. And it was just kind of lucked into it without any, I didn't pursue it or anything like that. It just sort of came up through a weird connection when that show was just starting. I had written a newspaper column about the show at my first newspaper job at a small paper in Medina, Ohio. And Mike Judge, the creator of the show, saw it, thought it was funny, sent me a note and said, basically the note said, I saw what you wrote. If you want to try writing an episode of the show, I would pay you $300. Ha, ha, ha. And he gave me his phone number. And so, you know, this was pre, you know, this was pre-email. This was 1993. So I called him up, and he said, yeah, if you want to try writing an episode of the show. I didn't even know what a newspaper, or a television script looked like, so he had to send me a stack of them, and he said, just copy the way it's done, and that's how it started.
So that sounds like
a blast.
Yeah, it sounds more like a challenge. Like
no, I mean it wasn't.
Oh, you think you can write? You can write. Can you write for Beavis and Butthead?
Well, it's not as easy as it looks. I would say that, and in fact, the hard way on purpose. The title of the book seems to capture a lot of how I seem to do things. I tried to make it harder than it was because I was trying to be. There was one point. Where I was trying to be really clever, you know, because I had a master's degree in creative writing, so I thought, I'm going to be like the Noel Coward of Beavis and Butthead. So I was trying to do these clever jokes and these one-liners, and I sent him the script, and we were doing stuff by fax machine at this time, because this was like, you know, email wasn't useful yet. And so I remember getting this fax from Mike Judge that just said, make it stupid. And in a way, it was the one of the best pieces of writing advice I've ever gotten, because I was just trying too hard.
So how often do you follow the make it stupid writing advice if it's one of the best pieces you've gotten?
More often than you would think, because, you know, I mean, that's one of the pitfalls of you know, struggling through the process is trying to be, you know, impressive, you know, or to appear smarter than you are. And, you know, that's, or at least for me, that's one of the things I have to fight against and just be natural, you mm-hmm. know, because that's what you're really trying to be when you're a writer is yourself. But how do you be yourself? You can't.
Right. Yeah. You know, now that you mention it, I remember the episode of Beavis and Butthead with the waiting for Godot references. It was really, that must have been yours. So I want to compliment you on that.
No.
One other.
No, I wrote one of the Cornholio episodes. That's about as intellectual as I ever got.
I do want to ask you about one other thing that you've written. You co-wrote Are We Not Men, We Are Devo, right?
Yes.
Covering Devo, the band, the punk band. I guess punk is encapsulates what they did. Tell me about mm-hmm. that experience. What was it like writing for as unusual a group as I think Devo probably was? Did you have access to?
I mean, that was something I had wanted to do for years, and I co-wrote that book with a writer and really great researcher named Jade Dellinger. And we both had the idea to do this book, and it made a great team. But there had not been a complete, definitive biography of that band. And I just think they're one of the most interesting bands, especially before they got famous, and really in rock and roll history, because they were this really fully evolved over a number of years philosophy of art and culture, and this idea of de-evolution was something they had written long essays about. And everything I'm saying sounds nothing like a rock band and nothing like something that would make for a good rock band. It sounds like it was bound for failure. And this is one of the things about this part of the country is that, you know, it's like good ideas die here all the time. And Devo somehow managed, like, to have this magic moment where they went through all this different personnel and, you know, working on these ideas and this, you know, high concept art project with, you know, costumes and all this stuff. And then they just clicked musically, and all of a sudden they were just like this kick-ass rock band that at the same time. And, like, I compare them to Kiss in that book, except Kiss's, you know, biggest idea was its costumes. You know, it didn't go beyond that to some philosophy of mankind or something like that. And Devo had that too, even though, you know, anyone who saw, you know, like the Whip It video in 1980 just saw the red hats and, you know, the right. fun, catchy beat, which was also there. But, you know, if you cared to explore it, there was so much more. And so that's why they were so much fun to write about.
Mm-hmm. So did you actually, what was that process like? Did you interview them? Was it, you had mentioned the other person?
Yeah,
did a lot of...
I mean, we, that, that, our relationship with the band soured as the project went on, because they, you know, one of the things, one of the sort of core things about Devo was how much they controlled their image. And so at some point they did not like the direction that our research was taking, which I understand. I mean, you know, that's, so we had good early access with, for the most part, but a lot of the research was done then through other sources as well. You know, my collaborator, Jade, had just exhaustive research already in place before we even began starting on working on it as a book project. So.
Okay. Well, okay. David Giffels, I want to thank you very much for talking to me today on Craft. And I encourage everybody to go see you on June 25th with the Thurber House.
Yeah, thanks, Ed. I'm really looking forward to coming back to the Thurber House. I had a blast the last time I was there, and looking forward to this reading.
And we'll look forward to your advice to people to make it stupid when you write and other other things. And this is where ideas go to die.
Yes, I'm chock full of advice for being stupid.
Yes. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Doug.
For more information from my guests, visit www.craftheshow.com. This is Doug Dangler. Until next time, be creative.